This is State of the Union, the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. I'm Chris Policano. DC 37 is New York City's largest public employee union. We've got 125,000 members and nearly 50,000 retirees. We're part of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, also known as AFSCME. We're on the air Sundays at 8 p.m. We rebroadcast on Wednesdays at 1:30 p.m. We're also available as a podcast. Simply go to the podcast app on your smartphone and search for DC 37 State of the Union. You can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Check out our website, www.dc37.net. Call our hotline, 212-815-7555, to stay abreast of DC 37 activities. And if you have any comments about this show, please drop us a line at stateoftheunion@dc37.net. Your feedback is always welcome. The immigration issue has been in the news much in these past weeks. Joining us now by phone is Paul Moses, former editor of Newsday. He's also the author of a couple of books. Welcome back to the show, sir.
Thanks, Chris. Good to be with you.
Before I forget, the last time you were on this program was to talk about your book, An Unlikely Union, which was not about the state of the labor movement, but was actually about the relationship between Italians and the Irish in this city. I hope that book is still available.
It is. It's in paperback now. Thanks for asking.
And so folks can get that on Amazon.com?
Yes. Yeah, it's in yes, and all the places online, and we do. I do deal with labor unions in that story.
Okay, well, I just wanted to get the plug out there because
thanks.
I thought that was a terrific book. I really liked that book.
Thanks.
You wrote a piece in Newsday last week about Rudy Giuliani, and you reminded readers that Rudy Giuliani, who is now one of the most rabid voices defending the Trump administration, was once upon a time, as mayor of the city of New York, a strong supporter of immigrants and this great mosaic city of ours.
Yes, very much so, Chris. He formed a national coalition to push against the immigration laws that were passed in the mid-1990s and later to try to change them. So he also went to court against the government to preserve the city's status as, for lack of a better word, I guess, a sanctuary city. In other words, that police would not turn over the names of undocumented immigrants they came in touch with or other government city agencies as well. So, he was quite eloquent. It wasn't just something he had a press conference or issued a press release, and that was it. He gave a number of speeches in different parts of the country about it.
And I mean, I was taken by the fact that, he is now one of the most visible folks defending, the president and his administration. And that administration has clearly been gone in a different direction than the one that Rudy Giuliani, the vision that Rudy Giuliani had as mayor. What do you think that's about?
Very much so. I really can't explain his turnaround on this, and I don't know in his heart of hearts where he stands on immigration. I do know that when he came out and told everybody that he had figured out a way to make President Trump's ban on Muslim immigration from certain countries legal, he was very proud of that. I suspect that he's probably tried to soften Trump a little bit on this, but that's just a suspicion. I don't know.
Listen, we're talking about this, in my opinion, we're talking about this because of Giuliani's resurgence or, revival as a public figure. And also because I was quite taken remembering Giuliani, having covered Giuliani, that he really did have a vision of what this city looked like and that this city's diversity was part of its greatness.
I mean, what always strikes me as a New Yorker is just from my own experience, I live in Brooklyn, And I just see many of the neighborhoods around where I live have been revived by immigration. Everybody talks about the results of gentrification, but immigration changed a lot of the city's neighborhoods for the better. And it's interesting to me that while he was mayor, Rudy Giuliani acknowledged that this was an important reason the city improved. It was one of those reasons that he couldn't even take credit for, and he liked to take credit for things he did. And in this case, he talked about different neighborhoods like Flushing and Brighton Beach and the parts of Brooklyn with a lot of Caribbean immigrants and so forth. And he was right. Anybody who knows the city has to see that. And that's why it's hard to see where Trump, as a New Yorker, is totally blind to this. The net, impact of immigration in New York has always been a positive.
And these are two guys from New York. These are two guys from the most international city in America, who have now joined forces to put forth opinions about who should be here and who should not. That's a throwback to a previous time in this country.
Yeah, oh, very much so. Very, very much so. And that is actually something we talked about when we talked about the book on the Irish and the Italians. I've been still reading up on what was being said about the Italians in the 1910s and 1920s, and we would definitely see an echo of that today. With this so-called Muslim ban, a travel order, and the way Mexican and Central American migrants are portrayed, it's very much reminiscent of that.
And Trump did this right. This was his first declaration as a candidate for president of the United States of America.
Yeah, no, he clearly based his campaign on that, and. I don't know, the Rudy Trump, where is Wayne Barrett when we need him?
Right.
He wrote great biographies of both of them, the late Wayne Barrett. There's a drama there that's yet to be fully explained. By rights, Trump ought to have been somebody he would have wanted to investigate in the 80s.
Giuliani would have investigated Trump.
Right. And it didn't, So, I don't know.
Yeah, I can hear you scratching your head as we talk about this.
But I covered Rudy Giuliani day to day also when he was U.S. attorney, and when he came in 1983, he really seemed really solid and eager to do what was right. And I don't know.
The transformation has been profound.
He was really very much. He talked a lot about ethics, not just publicly but privately. And I think it was just part of, how he'd been schooled and brought up and so forth to think about that stuff. But now with what he's doing, making wild accusations and it's really quite a change, because he just seems sharper and more grounded. Now he seems like he's
flailing.
Yeah. Although I think he's shrewder than people. Some people will say at this point, because I think he's got I think he's recognized some of the legal problems that Trump has, and he's trying to deal with them in whatever way he can.
We're talking with Paul Moses, who was former editor of Newsday. City editor of Newsday.
Yes.
And while we're talking about the city, and we've got about 5 minutes left, you wrote a piece about a year ago bemoaning the death of local news coverage in New York. Let's talk a little bit about that and how the lack of local news coverage affects the way the city runs.
Yeah, I wrote these two lengthy pieces for the Daily Beast, so they're still up there on the shrinkage of local news coverage in New York City. And when you really put up, what was done in the past against what's done now, it's really dramatic. So I started out my reporting by going to a place I once covered, the Queens Courthouse in Kew Gardens. I was a reporter in the press room there. And that press room is locked now. It's only opened up if there's a really big story and people, you know, reporters come in. But that day-to-day coverage that you get, used to get, is gone. And I think we've seen the impact of that just very recently with this election in which Joe Crowley lost his Democratic primary race. Knowing what was going on in the world of Queens Boulevard and Queens politics, that's just something you did a lot better when, say, the Daily News and Newsday had a total between them of about 15 reporters in Queens.
And now you're
maybe
saying
more.
And what number has that been reduced to?
Zero.
There is nobody in Queens for Newsday or the Daily News.
And at that time, it's long gone also. And so for a while, we had DNA Info, which I think did that job of bringing good reporters in to cover local beats. But they unfortunately didn't make it. And but that's a perfect example. A lot of people were stunned and shocked. And where was the media on the story? And it's just that, you know, you can't cover congressional races locally from Washington. You need local news reporters. And we see the same thing. You know, eventually it works its way into the national politics, because if you don't have good statehouse bureaus around the country, there's not going to be really good information coming out on the statewide politics of those states.
There is something called I think it's called the Statewide Policy Network, which actually is an anti-union group that formed its own sort of news bureau, trying to provide news to local media, or, you know, as a syndication.
Yeah.
And it's and we've had to fight against these folks, but they're providing what could be described as a service, you know, clandestinely, because they're pushing forward views that are, you know, anti-working folks. But there's a hole to be filled, and they have filled it out in the Midwest.
Really, that's very interesting, Chris. I wasn't aware of that.
It's just amazing that the local coverage, the lack of a Queens bureau, the lack of understanding what's happening in local politics, in local issues, that's important to the lifeblood, and also to the ability of folks to understand the city in which they live.
Yeah, no, there are efforts in town right now to figure out better ways to cover the news locally, to enhance the coverage.
But how do you make money on it? Is the problem? Correct?
Well, no, I didn't say that.
Oh.
For example, foundation funding has helped WMYC expand its radio coverage quite a bit over time. And it's quite good. They have, you know, beat reporters in a lot of different areas. They're not set up to do what, you know, a newspaper with, you know, five or six, seven times as many local reporters could do. But that's an attempt to expand things. So I think the next step is hopefully some sort of, nonprofit funded news service, and not one that's, I don't think it would be one that's funded by, some kind of special interest type sort of situation.
Right. Paul Moses is the former city editor of Newsday. He is the author of An Unlikely Union, which is a terrific book that everyone should go out and read. I want to thank you, Paul, for taking the time to talk with us.
Yeah, it's a pleasure, Chris. Thanks.
And I'll see you around. We'll be right back.
Were you a September 11th responder or volunteer? Were you present at the dust cloud on 9/11? Do you live, work, or go to school in the New York City disaster area on 9/11 or in the following months? Do you now suffer from problems such as chronic cough, shortness of breath, anxiety, depression, or have other symptoms? If so, you may be eligible for the World Trade Center Health Program and could receive medical monitoring and treatment at no out-of-pocket cost to you. To learn more about the program and get an application, go to www.cdc.gov/WTC or call 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care. Call today. 1-888-982-4748. 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care.
We're back. This is State of the Union, the DC 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. I'm Chris Policano. Joining us now is someone who's been, well, welcome back, sir. Bruce Cannon is a master puppeteer. You've been on this show before. You work at the Swedish Cottage. I love this. You work at, like I'm telling him where he works at, as if he doesn't know where he works. Yes. The Swedish Cottage Marionette Theater in Central Park. There are two new shows coming up.
Yes. Well, it's good to be back, Chris. Yes, we have two new shows coming back. One at our theater in Central Park, the Swedish Cottage Marionette Theater. It's called Neverland Peter Returns, and it's a wonderful new version with wonderful new music playing at the Swedish Cottage Marionette Theater in Central Park. And that will be running from now through September. And we also have our touring show, which goes around to all the city parks and playgrounds throughout New York City. And we've been doing that since 1939, by the way. And
is this the season for that? The summer season
yes,
is when
yes,
that happens? Summer,
it's from basically from May through October. And we're doing something called the Big Good Wolf.
The Big Good Wolf.
Instead of the Big Bad Wolf, we have the Big Good Wolf.
Well, there you go. He's been getting bad press for years. It's about time somebody do a little PR for the Wolf, huh?
He's redeemed in this version, yes.
I've maintained from the moment I met you that you have one of the best jobs in the city, and you've been doing this for a while. How long has it been since you first started doing the puppet theater? And remind us how you got started in this.
Okay, so I've been doing it since 1975. A year right out of high school. I mean, I went to Music and Art High School, which is now LaGuardia High School. So I went there, and a year after high school, I found myself back in New York after trying a year in an all-black college called Virginia State. It didn't work for me. It was a wonderful black college experience. Don't get me wrong on that.
But it was in the state of Virginia.
But it was in Virginia, and I missed New York.
Okay.
So I end up back in New York and looking for work. And because I had a background in the arts, I was called as part of the CEDA program to work in parks and recreation. And at my interview, Mary Purcell, wonderful lady, I think she's been at parks even longer than I have. Okay, but she suggested that the director of the puppet theater come into my interview. And he interviewed me, and they assigned me to the puppet theater, and the rest is history. So since 1975, I've been there in one form or another, and I became the director in 1996.
And you were also an officer of one of the DC 37 locals, Local 299.
That's right.
And you are the treasurer of that local. Let's take a step back to the Big Good Wolf. Is this something that gets into your head and you write this out? How do these shows come about?
Well, what I like to do is I like to take the children's classics that we know and love so well, and I like to make them more multicultural and multimedia. So this particular version is sort of a mesh-up between the three pigs and the three bears. And in this particular version, he has three fairy god mice who task him to do some wonderful things so that he can become, instead of the big bad wolf, the big good wolf. So initially, he just... He messes it up totally. but he goes into the Three Bears house. He trashes the house. So in this version, Baby Bear and Goldilocks are friends. So it's an interesting mashup of two stories. But lo and behold, at the end, he becomes the big good wolf.
Well, it's interesting how the Big Bear Wolf is a very scary. How you approach subjects with kids and how you come at things. If you grew up under Disney, you were terrified of a million things. That's because right. Disney made stuff scary.
That's right.
You seem to be taking a different approach to this.
That's right. And just like one of the things I do like about the Disney formula, though, is that they appeal to children and adults.
Yes.
So we in our versions, we have a lot of humor and stuff that might totally go over the children's head, but the adults they're right there. They get it.
Well, one wouldn't necessarily think of a master puppeteer as a union job, but we're trying. As we're talking at this during this time when unions are under assault and people are trying to, defang unions and bust unions, and there's a Supreme Court case now that the decision's going to come down at any point that could have a lot to say about the future of public employee unions. How is the union, as you reflect upon your experience, your career, how has the union let you do what you do?
Well, I mean, I think that first of all, we're blessed to have a union job in the arts. So I think that the fact that it's part of the Parks and Recreation Center, and a lot of people back in the day during the LaGuardia administration had the foresight to put this together, it was a wonderful thing. But interestingly enough, through the years, the puppet theater was threatened to be closed. And it was the unions that kept it open. You know, it was like, no, we have this gym in Central Park. You will not, you have workers that are provisional or whatever, but this is a civil service job that was created, and we are going to maintain that. And many times that was threatened through the Beam administration, obviously, through the Koch administration, through the Giuliani. I mean, through just about every administration. I mean, part of our blessing is the public-private partnership that we have with City Parks Foundation. That helps a lot. But even with that, if we did not have the union support, I don't think this theater would still be around.
Well, when programs are being cut, it's always the union that's standing up for the programs, and those programs benefit the communities.
There you go.
And sometimes the newspapers get it wrong. They're talking about, they're trying to protect jobs. No, we're trying to protect services.
That's right, right, right.
And people have to provide those services, and those are jobs.
That's right. They're important jobs, and the role that we play And exposing children to theater is so very important. So it's wonderful that we have the unions that get this and that keeps on supporting us and fighting for us when we need it, and we definitely need it during this administration.
And how did you get to be more active in your local to the point where you became an officer? I mean, how did that experience? Did somebody come to you? Was there a meeting?
I was found. Unions interesting, and I didn't quite understand them at first until I started getting involved, and then I started understanding the importance of it, and you know, the fights through the years, and you know, so through the civil rights movement, through the human rights movement. I mean, you start seeing the importance of union and how it's so very important, and even more important nowadays. So I think at first, and I think most people don't understand unions, but when they get to be a member and they get to see what the benefits do and what unions are fighting for and what they've fought for historically, I think people get it.
Well, I clearly in the last in 2008, 2007, unions were at a very low point in terms of popularity. Those numbers have risen and have continued to rise along with the politics.
That's right.
And since November of 2016, there was a poll just recently I saw that said 51% of folks think that the decline of unions is a bad thing versus 35% of people who think it's a good thing. So the public perception of unions have changed as people understand, whoa, there's like... Yes, all institutions are flawed. Mm-hmm. Everything involving people have problems. Mm-hmm. But the union, the whole purpose of the union is to help communities and people.
Right, as long as they have unscrupulous employers, which they always will have, there will be a need for unions. And I think the fact that McDonald's workers and people like that have wanted to unionize, I mean, I think that that sends out a powerful message as well.
We're talking with Bruce Cannon. He is a master puppeteer and treasurer of Local 299. His puppet shows are at the Swedish Cottage Marionette Theater in Central Park. They also, this time of the year, go around the city to other parks in the city.
And parks and playgrounds throughout the five boroughs.
Let me ask you one question. We've got to cut this short because we got to do a couple of announcements. Mm-hmm. But the future master puppeteers, do you see them? Are they coming? How do you interact with them? Is what you do something that's going to be done in 20 years?
Well, I think that that's a great question, an important question, and that's part of my legacy, is to make sure that we have the next generation of master marionette puppeteers. So that's part of my mission. And as we speak, I'm training and mentoring younger puppeteers so that this rare art form will go on and on and on.
Okay, give me in 30 seconds again the rundown for the shows that are coming up and where they are and how to get more information about
it. So at the Swedish Cottage Marionette Theater, you can go to cityparksfoundation.org to get the schedule for that. But we're doing Neverland Peter Returns. It's a wonderful modern version, or I would just say a more contemporary version of Peter Pan. And we also have our touring show, which goes around to city parks and playgrounds throughout New York City from now through the end of October, and you could once again get that information to see when the show is going to be in your neighborhood. You can get that information at cityparksfoundation.org as well.
And that's about the big good wolf.
Yeah.
And the poor guy's been getting bad PR, bad play for a long time.
Yes.
Bruce Cannon, thank you for being with us. That's just about all the time we have for this evening. I want to do a couple of announcements before we go. Check out the Ed Fund on our website, www.dc37.net. The Education Fund of DC37 will be offering summer classes at Union Headquarters. And also the Municipal Employees Legal Services reminds you that they provide legal representation to members when applying for citizenship. For more information, call 212-815-1818. I want to thank our guests, Paul Moses and Bruce Cannon. Remember, if you have any comments about today's or any of our shows, please drop us a line at stateoftheunion@dc37.net. If you're listening to this on Sunday, July 8th, you can go to 970 a.m. at 9 p.m. We'll be talking about Janice on the Labor Press radio show. The producer of this show is Rudy Orozco. The sound engineer is Andrea Minocchio. I'm Chris Policano. Until next time, ciao.